After police killed George Floyd in Minneapolis last month, the Minneapolis public school system moved to end its relationship with the city's police department. Now, some local leaders in Boston are calling for similar action. Joining me on the line is Boston City Councilor Andrea Campbell, chair of the council's Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice. Councilor, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
So, Councilor Campbell, why do you feel this is important? I know you started your career advocating for children in schools. Are you drawing on personal experience with this advocacy here?
Absolutely. I'm a former education attorney. I used to represent students, particularly low-income and students of color, in school discipline cases and special education cases. And all my families had to fall below the poverty line. So I know firsthand through that work and also through personal experience through relatives that poor children and children of color, often their first encounter with the criminal justice system is at their school, and that it can lead to permanent entanglement with our detention and prison systems.
One of the criticisms that we've heard as this conversation has come forward is that it's part of what's sometimes referred to as a cradle-to-prison pipeline. Can you elaborate on what that means a little bit more and what you mean when you say first encounter with the criminal justice system might be at school?
Right. So, you know, when I was doing that education work, I also worked with the Children's Defense Fund and many advocates around dismantling the cradle-to-prison pipeline, which shows through tremendous research and data that one in three boys, I think was born back in 2001, will end up in our criminal justice system compared to one in 16 white boys. And there are similar stats for girls, and actually girls were on the uptick in terms of their involvement with the criminal justice system, and it starts early. And so as we're talking about policing reform, we have to also be talking about criminal justice reform and the role in which officers show up in our schools and how that may lead to the over-incarceration of our young black and brown residents, as well as our low-income constituents.
So, Councilor, I want to comb this out a little bit. Most of the officers in Boston Public Schools are school resource officers who are school department employees, although they can make arrests. And then the Boston Police Department has its own separate unit of school police officers. It's a smaller group. Are you talking about or advocating for getting both kinds of officers out of schools?
No, and I was having some conversations with folks who serve in our police department school unit. So I am not advocating for the elimination of the police department school unit, where these officers are not regularly showing up in our schools, but are uniquely trained to respond to school incidents and to build relationships with our schools and our school leadership and teachers in the case of an emergency, right? I'm specifically focusing on our Boston Public Schools, who currently employ over 70 school resource officers who are deputized to serve as police officers. So they wear a uniform, they have handcuffs, and saying instead that we need to look at these roles differently and to look at increasing the number of counselors and social workers available for our students.
To that end, is that what you would do instead? You know, if the Boston Public Schools didn't have school resource officers, what would you advocate for as a replacement?
So the school resource officers could, for example, be trained to show up in more of a social, emotional support way versus a school police, right? We deputize them. We train them to show up in a more law enforcement model. And I'm saying repurpose them and then expand the amount of resources available to make sure every young person in our school has access to a nurse, social worker, someone who is clinically trained, so to make sure that they are not only belonging and feeling a sense of belonging in a community, but that the community is equipped to deal with our students who are coming with a lot of different things, but equipped to deal with them and give them supports they need to make our schools safer. You need to create a community, and the police officer's model is not the way to go in our schools.
You know, there will be those who would argue that safety actually is preserved by having these school resource officers who are deputized, to use the word you used earlier. Sometimes schools are dangerous places. What do you say to people who are concerned about losing the safety dimension of having such officers in the school environment?
Prove it, right? As of right now, we know our police unit within our police department is effective, right? They do incredible work to build relationships up. In terms of our school resource officers and metal detectors, this idea of criminalizing our students at so early an age or taking that approach to protect the public or safety concerns, there's tremendous data and research that demonstrates the way in which you create a safe school is by creating a community where every student feels a sense of belonging and connection with one another. And the way you do that is to have human capital in the form of guidance counselors, mental health supports, more human capital designed to focus on the social-emotional wellness of our students, not on the law enforcement model within our schools. And God forbid something does happen, we are blessed that we have an incredible unit within the police department that do incredible work with respect to our schools and safety. And we'll continue to do that work. This is instead about the critical supports that our students need from a social-emotional wellness perspective, and law enforcement and school resource officers playing that role is not the way to go.
Counselor, I want to read you a little bit of a statement by Mayor Walsh, Superintendent Brenda Caselius, and Police Commissioner William Gross. The part I'll read is, quote, "The safety and well-being of students remains our collective priority always, and we recognize the importance in identifying ways to uphold this mission while also ensuring our school buildings are welcoming learning environments for all students. Together, we've been reviewing opportunities to improve how our teams work together in schools and neighborhoods, and we will continue engaging in important dialogue with stakeholders to ensure all BPS community members feel safe, respected, and valued." I want to ask your response to that and ask you if you see city leaders moving in the direction that you want them to here.
So first of all, we have to be transparent. And so there was, I think, initially a reluctance to release data on where do we have these school resource officers. They're not in every school. So what schools are they in? Are they in the schools that are in certain neighborhoods that have a reputation of violence? And if so, what does that say to our young people? So transparency around where these school resources officers are based is critically important. And then this is the time to have a conversation about different approaches. We know that the policing model, the law enforcement model, does not work in certain communities to reduce violence. And so how do we use models like the Youth Connect model, an organization right here in Boston that says not police officers, resource officers in our schools, instead clinical social workers, other ways to create that sense of community so that folks do not feel inclined to commit awful acts. The root causes of getting at these behaviors, that's difficult work. It is hard. It requires different models, but the law enforcement model is not the way to go within our schools. We have to think differently and we have to be creative. In this conversation right now, our residents are demanding us to look at systems and to reimagine them differently. And the policing conversation has to also connect to the school officers' conversation as well.
And that is City Councilor Andrea Campbell, Chair of the Council's Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And now some news about WBUR ourselves today. The station announced that it will lay off more than 10% of the station's staff, including several newsroom leaders, and stop producing the nationally syndicated sports program Only a Game in a major restructuring. Just a little earlier this afternoon, we asked WBUR CEO Margaret Lowe about the 29 cuts here at WBUR.
The cuts are all across the organization. The reason for the cuts is twofold. One, we were and have been impacted by the fall in underwriting due to the COVID crisis. Importantly, it is also a reorganization creating what we hope is a really, really strong WBUR going forward.
So Margaret, can you give us some sense of the balance there? What percentage of the move that you made today is the result of restructuring you were already planning? And what percentage of it is a result of the global pandemic and the financial losses from that?
It's a little bit hard to break it down, Tiziana. I think I would account for a lot of it as being part of the restructuring, and part of what one has to do is think about where you want to go, what your ambitions are, and what you need to stop doing in order to do that. We are an incredibly strong local news organization, and we're doubling down on our journalism and our programming and programs like Radio Boston, so that we can really be a presence in the life of our audiences in this city and beyond.
So you just said focusing in part on what you need to stop doing. What does the station need to stop doing in your mind?
It's always hard to say what you need to stop doing. But one of the things, you know, for example, one of the decisions we made was to stop producing a wonderful program called Only a Game, which has been on the air for 27 years. It's public radio's only sports program, and it's distributed nationally, and it's been an important part of people's weekends for many years. And the reason we stopped doing it is because it was expensive to produce and the economy just wouldn't support producing something of that nature anymore. And like BUR, lots of our public radio colleagues across the country have had to make similar cuts to programs that they love, but just can't afford to produce anymore.
So to that end, how difficult is the financial situation at WBUR right now? Is the station stable? Are there more cuts coming?
Look, I hope there are not more cuts coming. The station, what we did today was in order to stabilize the station and our finances, and really importantly, to remain ambitious about our future as a beloved and trusted institution in Boston that's known for its sophisticated, smart, deep journalism and programming. And in order to double down on that, part of what we also needed to do was to add jobs to shore up our journalism. So at the same time as we're making hard cuts, and it's never easy, we're also going to continue to be bringing people into our ranks to make us an even stronger news organization.
So as you know, WBUR and the union representing reporters, editors, engineers, other employees have come to a tentative contract agreement this week. That is still not ratified. The union put out a statement which reads in part, quote, WBUR CEO Margaret Lowe declined to consult with union leaders before making layoffs and repeatedly refused to consider buyouts, furloughs, or pay reductions that have preserved jobs at NPR and have the support of many members of our unit, end quote. I want to ask you both your response to that and why WBUR did not consider asking staff to make those sacrifices in order to reduce layoffs.
Tiziana, let me take those. There are sort of two pieces of what you just asked. You said that I declined to consult with union leaders before making layoffs, and that's simply not true. We negotiated the terms of the layoffs with the union, even though they're not part of the proposed contracts, and we added 10 weeks of severance in the final negotiations in direct response to your union request. On the union points about buyouts, furloughs, and pay cuts, that's true. And, you know, just the other day, I was reading how the LA Times has lost talented journalists of color to other publications because it can't compete on pay. And I don't want to be in that position. Our commitment to local journalism is unwavering and unaffected by these cuts. And I'm determined to diversify our ranks and to continue to attract the kind of top-notch journalists that WBUR listeners have come to expect. And that's immeasurably harder if we impose pay cuts. And the other thing, Tiziana, is that furloughs implicitly assume we'll be back to prior budget levels relatively quickly. And I can't say with any confidence that that's the case. We continue to attract strong support from our members and big dollar donors, but our underwriting has taken a huge hit and it's not clear that that's coming back anytime soon. I'm thinking about the long term and the long term health of your organization and the people who work here.
So I want to ask you about diversity at WBUR, Margaret. According to reporter Callum Borscher's article on the cuts, you named 8 current employees who will take on prominent new roles in the restructured organization. 7 of them are white. How committed is the organization to diversity when that's the restructuring decision, and how does that commitment then manifest going forward?
It's a good and it's a really important question, and in part, the people who were promoted were our talented, terrific journalists and leaders. And WBUR has to double down on hiring, developing leaders of color. We need to add more leaders of color to our ranks. And it's vital to me and it's vital to our future. And we have a lot of work to do. And this is an absolute priority to me.
Margaret, before we let you go, put this in context. With the massive disruptions we're seeing in local news, in broadcast journalism, print journalism, I understand we're in a moment of a pandemic, but we've been in a moment of a larger upheaval in news, and I'm sure it's on our listeners' minds.
Yeah, what I want to say to our listeners, to our audiences, wherever they find us, is that there has probably never been a moment where the value and importance of local news is more paramount. The combination of a pandemic and its impact on Boston and Massachusetts, people desperately need to find out what's happening where they live. And the same is true in the wake of the police killing of George Floyd and everything that unfolded across the country. It's been a real reckoning. and an important one, and shines the light on the possibility that there can be real and lasting change in terms of racial equity and racial justice in this country. And that was both an important national story, a global story, and an intensely local story. And we have journalists who hit the ground on all these stories, and I think they're doing an extraordinary job capturing the urgency of the moment and shining a light where it needs to be. And I'm immensely proud of our coverage and the stories we're telling and the reporting that we're doing. And we are not going to let up.
And that's WBUR's Margaret Lowe, the CEO. Margaret, thanks for joining Radio Boston.
Tiziana, thank you so much.
And briefly, we received a response from the WBUR union. It says, quote, "We did not know the scope or nature of the layoffs and that blind negotiating a severance package and having a kind of hands-on collaborative approach to save jobs are different things," end quote. The MBTA is facing down profound financial challenges due to this pandemic. The Massachusetts Taxpayers Foundation, a business-backed think tank, warns that by 2022, the T could have an operating budget deficit of over $400 million, a shortfall that could present an existential threat for the agency. Eileen McEnany is the president of Massachusetts Taxpayer Foundation, and she joins me now. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Eileen.
Good afternoon, Tiziana. Thank you.
Also with us is Jared Johnson, the chief operating officer of Transit Matters. Jared, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And listeners, join this conversation. Are you still riding the MBTA? If you're not, what will get you back on trains and buses again? Are you concerned about the long-term health of the system? What that could mean for Massachusetts? Call us, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So Eileen, I want to start with you. Your report said the budget shortfall facing the T is existential. What does that mean? How bad is the picture?
Well, it's pretty dire, and I would say that the MBTA has not been spared the pandemic's impacts, right? We've heard a lot about the pandemic's impact on the greater economy, certainly on the state budget, and I think it has hit the MBTA as well. But this time around, things are a little different, and as you know, the Mass Taxpayers Foundation has been focused on the MBTA's finances for quite a while. We had issued a report back in 2015 called The T, the End of Its Line, where we were sounding the alarm bell back then about some of the fiscal challenges and the operational challenges. And after 5 years of progress by the Fiscal and Management Control Board, we seem to be backpedaling.
So in a statement, the MBTA told us that the outlook is, quote, directionally accurate from your report, end quote. But they do say they'll be, quote, taking actions during fiscal year 2021 to further reduce costs for fiscal 2022 in advance of developing and finalizing the fiscal year 22 budget. So I want to get your reaction to that and sort of your sense of the biggest drivers of the way you're projecting the shortfall and if the T's response might change those projections.
Yeah, well, I think it's always important to note that with any projection, you're doing it at a point in time, right? And so with the best information we have, that is our current projection. And so certainly if the MBTA takes measures in this short term that fundamentally changes the direction of those numbers, then that projection would have to be revised. So, and that's actually good news to hear, that the MBTA will proactively do things to address the shortfall. Our purpose was simply to kind of give the governance structure that will succeed the Fiscal Management Control Board a status report of where things stand so that there would be an urgency about their work and there would be an immediate focus on these issues.
So let me turn to you, Jared, and get your reaction to the financial picture in the report from the Mass Taxpayers Foundation.
Yeah, I think the you know, what the report is real clear about is that resources are needed, and that, you know, anything less than, you know, new resources from Beacon Hill, and, you know, to a certain extent, at least in the short term, from Washington, you know, is going to, you know, amount to an abandonment. And, you know, if we want to have a quick recovery from COVID and from the financial and economic impact, we need to have a strong transit system.
And so what does that mean during a time when we know that ridership, for real reasons, concern about public safety, the transmission of a pandemic disease, is going to mm-hmm. suppress ridership revenues?
Yeah, you know, I think what that means is that, you know, we have to continue providing, you know, service for our essential workers, you know, because on certain lines, you know, the ridership, you know, never dropped below, you know, high 33% of the everyday ridership, and that is growing, you know, each and every day as we start to reopen, you know, different sectors of the economy. And so, you know, we do have to think about transportation as what it is, which is a public good. And so, you know, there is a need to fund it, even when, you know, revenues from fares are down, and that the, you know, the ability of the T to provide enough service to keep crowding low and continue up with their cleaning regime, you know, and hopefully see them providing masks and doing some of these other things that do cost money. That's also essential to gaining the public's trust and confidence in getting back onto the system.
Eileen, I'm going to ask you the same question. I mean, the pandemic has created a good deal of this precarious situation. You got an entire pool of riders that have evaporated. Jared's laid out some of the things the T would need to do to bring that ridership back. Is bringing that ridership back the only solution here? And you know, how do we think about what the T needs to do next?
Well, it's definitely a fundamental part of the solution. And I think, you know, we need to do what it takes to instill confidence in the riding public, in the commuting public. And I know we can't do it too quickly because there's a balancing act here for the MBTA as it tries to adhere to social distancing protocols that, you know, not as many riders will fit in cars and so forth. And so it definitely is a balancing act, but I think instilling confidence by making sure the public is aware that they have increased cleaning, that they are doing all that they can to make it a safe experience and a reliable experience is going to be key. I mean, in the short term, you know, that they will need more resources. Hopefully the federal government will, you know, provide some of them because, as we know, the state's fiscal situation has also been challenged by the pandemic, right? According to our most recent revenue estimate, the state's looking at a $6 billion deficit. And so, again, maybe the federal government will provide assistance and can fill that gap. But it's a pretty precarious situation.
So to that point, Jared, when budgets are precarious, we know that there's real vulnerability for those who have the least voice in the public sphere, and that can include people of color, low-income workers, et cetera, those who also, as you have already pointed out, rely heavily on public transportation for their work, economic viability. So as we face what it sounds like will be serious budget deficits for the next couple of years, how do we keep equity in the forefront while addressing those budget concerns?
Yeah, you know, I think it's about really making sure that those riders' voices are represented on Beacon Hill, and I think it's about prioritizing their needs. I think, you know, there's going to have to be a tough conversation about, you know, where buses are allocated, and where, you know, train operators are allocated. And I think what's really key is making sure that we prioritize, you know, those communities, those environmental justice communities, those Black and Brown communities where the bulk of the essential riders are coming from. I think that's how we center those folks and how we make sure that their voices aren't left behind in a really tough budget cycle.
Let's turn to our callers. Are you riding the T? If not, when will you get back on the T? Are you concerned about the T's revenue shortfall, about its long-term viability? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have Helen on the line from Cambridge. Helen, what's on your mind?
I ride the red line between Porter and Central, and there's been talk about how busy they are cleaning the T. I want to say that the red line is filthier than it has ever been. 2 days after it rains, there are still muddy footprints all over the platforms. There are pigeons flying around in Porter Station, pooping on the escalators. It's really quite scary because if they aren't doing the regular cleaning, it's hard to believe that they're doing the special cleaning they talk about. There's also a huge maintenance backup. I mean, Porter Square is underground. There's groundwater leaking through. All kinds of, you know, wall panels are rusting through and will have to be replaced. So whatever they think they have as a budget for maintenance is going to have to be greatly increased.
Helen, thanks for that. And Eileen, I'll turn back to you on that, and Jared, actually. So two pieces there. You know, maintenance, which is addressed in your report, Eileen. And Jared, you know, you talked about the cleaning to put riders back on. We hear Helen saying, if there's sort of a baseline dirt or filth to it, how do, can I feel confident that the kind of sanitization that's necessary for me to be safe from the pandemic is happening? You guys can feel free to jump in either way there.
Well, I would say, you know, I agree with the caller, right, that there has to be visible signs that the amount of cleaning has increased. And I think that that's critically important to instill confidence. And with respect to the maintenance, you know, I would say there's two aspects to maintenance. Certainly the regular routine maintenance that should be part of the operating budget. And then there is a capital investment piece where there are actual improvements made to the system. And we are going to issue a second report that focuses on the capital outlook. And so that will be part of a second report. And the third will be just, you know, how to go forward, you know, given all of these challenges, which will be the more difficult of the most difficult of the three to write. But, you know, I think having visible cleanliness is a key aspect to this for sure.
Jared, anything you want to add?
Yeah, I'd absolutely echo that. And you know, not to dismiss, you know, what the caller is saying, because it's you know, it is incredibly important. And you know, perception is reality. I do know that they have said, and I don't know if it's the case, you know, at Porter, but they have said that you may see, you know, trash on the ground, or you may see some other things, because they're really focusing on cleaning the poles and cleaning the cleaning the escalator hand, you know, handrails and things like that. But that's still not an excuse. And I think that, you know, very few people are going to get that message. And so it's important that they both, you know, prioritize the, you know, the high touch surfaces, but also make sure that you don't have trash or pigeon and pigeon excrement, sort of contributing to an overall look of uncleanliness, because, you know, that's a huge part of how people perceive the tea and how they perceive whether or not it's being cleaned.
Before we run out of time, I do want to make sure to ask you both about the Fiscal Management Control Board. It was developed after problems in 2015, which led to its creation. Its sort of statutory tenure ends at the end of June. Governor Baker is pushing for some new board, with the majority of those members being appointed by the governor himself. I want to ask each of you, what is the right next step after the Fiscal Management Control Board, and what should that oversight and governance look like? Eileen?
Sure. Well, I would say we were strong proponents of the Fiscal and Management Control Board because we thought there needed to be a board dedicated to the MBTA, so separate from the Mass Department of Transportation Board. We still agree with that. So I think any successor governance structure should be a dedicated one. I do think one of the criticisms I've heard about the Fiscal Management Control Board is they've had so many public meetings that they spend an inordinate amount of time preparing for them and not doing the work, you know, at hand. And so I think striking the right balance to provide transparency to the public, but to allow folks to, you know, to actually run the day-to-day operations is key. But they need to do it.
So I'm going to take it.
Yeah.
I'm going to take it back from you there, Eileen, just because we have only about a minute left, sure. And I want to give Jared a chance to talk about governance too. Jared, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I echo everything Eileen has said. I think one of the things that's really important to note is, you know, that the FMCB has been really great at cutting, you know, the rate of operating growth. And I think a big reason why, you know, it's gone up this year is because of the safety report. And so I think that's one of the things that we have to balance is, you know, yes, you know, we want to make sure that the operating budget, you know, isn't growing and it's going out of control. But the thing that the safety panel really, you know, pointed out is that they need more money on the operating side for that maintenance. And so I hope that the new board can really zero in on that and really weigh that tough balance on keeping, you know, keeping the financial, you know, going in the right direction, but also really prioritizing safety and making those investments that are needed for safe service.
All right. That's Jared Johnson, the Chief Operating Officer of Transit Matters. Jared, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And Eileen McEnany, President of Massachusetts Taxpayers Foundation. Eileen, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Now, in ordinary times, many of us would be celebrating graduates of all kinds during this time of year. But as we know, these are not ordinary times. And that goes for high school graduates who missed out on the traditional markers of their senior year, like prom, graduation, other important rituals.
We'll be able to celebrate together at some point. These tough times won't last, so eventually it'll be over and we'll be able to have fun again and hopefully all see each other.
You know, the hard work did pay off in the end. We're all going somewhere. We're all doing something next year. And even if it's not in person, none of what we did was in vain, even though we won't be able to have, like, our graduations or necessarily see each other soon.
At the beginning, before all of this, it seemed like, oh, we're going to have, like, the worst end of senior year ever. But, you know, the whole country, you know, everyone's, like, saying congratulations, class of 2020, and everyone is trying to help out as best they could to make it a good end of the, you know, this educational journey.
Those are the voices of Paul Vozella, Bendu David, and Rory Andrews, all reflecting on the loss of the end of their senior year. So today, that's what we're going to talk about. We will talk with a few local students, and we want to hear from you. If you're a high school graduate, how are you feeling about the way your senior year ended, or kind of didn't? About missing out on prom, sports seasons, other special occasions? What message do you want to send to your classmates? And if you're a parent or a family member of a high school grad or an educator or a member of a school community, how does it feel not to see these students have that traditional senior year closure? Do you have a message of encouragement for them? Give it on air. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Joining us today are Kateri Giglio and Rashad Brown Mitchell, two recent graduates from Fenway High School. Kateri and Rashad, welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
Great to have you. And we have a third voice. We have Mattingly Wood, a recent graduate from Cambridge Ringe and Latin. Mattingly, welcome to you too.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so I have a senior at home who graduated herself last week. I know how weird it was, so let me turn to the three of you and start by saying, I think you all graduated last week. Congratulations, how are you feeling? And you guys just jump
Thank
on in
you.
At each other. I'll take care of it. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. And yeah, at least from Fenway, we did graduate last week over YouTube Live. Although it wasn't like a traditional graduation, of course, I thought it was still a really considerate way to do it. And I thought it was a beautiful ceremony nonetheless.
Yeah.
How
like
about
adding
you,
on. To, oh yeah. Adding on to like what Kat said, Fenway did just have their graduation last week. And I think with the graduation, it was really cool to see. Obviously it's a different type of schedule because it is remote. But just that and the other virtual events that have gone on throughout the month of June to celebrate the seniors at Fenway, I think have been really great. And it shows the appreciation that the teachers, the faculty, and all the families have. So it was really cool to see. And it was weird, but, you know, still appreciative.
How about you, Mattingly?
Yeah, I definitely share the feeling of it being really weird and kind of watching your ceremony in the living room. But I felt like the whole ceremony was still pretty amazing, and at least having the like having a whole ceremony being built around us was very rewarding.
Kat, did anyone do anything special for you to help you celebrate or mark the moment?
Well, in my house, we haven't been able to do exactly like a lot, but we do plan. Well, my parents are planning on throwing a little like graduation party, kind of just with like, you know, close family, but not yet. I think we're going to do it like towards the end of the month.
Rashad, how about you? Any special plans, any particular way to market that you've already done or that you wish you could do given the current circumstances?
No, not really. I think my family may have something planned for me, but like in terms of my own plans, I'm kind of good just reflecting back on all that's been going, all that has happened throughout high school. So yeah, I think my family may have like a celebration party or something that they want to plan. Me, I'm not too like huge on celebrations, and I'm just glad that I made it this far. So that's my take. Yeah.
So you'd rather just lay low and kind of move on to the next thing, Rashad?
Yeah, but that's kind of my thing. So it's kind of weird from everyone else. So yeah.
So Mattingly, how was school before things closed down?
It was pretty normal. It was about the middle of my semester two. I was getting really into my classes. So it was kind of like a really abrupt stop. And it was like a really big shift in routine. Like I felt like I was finally getting used to like the second semester of senior year and, you know, like wrapping everything up. So it was definitely very dramatic.
All right, I want to grab a call here right away. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Noelle on the line from Norfolk. Noelle, you're on with our high school seniors. What's on your mind?
Well, it's funny. I was just listening to Mattingly, what she said about getting in the groove her senior year, and then all of a sudden it came to a stop. I watched my daughter her senior year of college this year. Everything came to an abrupt stop, and you know, this is a big deal to graduate from high school, and it's a really big deal to earn a four-year degree. And yet, you know, school stopped for a week or two and then started up remotely, but everybody was quarantined back home, or you were in your off-campus apartment quarantined by yourself for, you know, 2 months. And then there was no real big graduation ceremony. It was just you got your cap and gown in the mail and you know, we couldn't have graduation parties and they couldn't walk across the stage or throw their hats into the air and, you know, diplomas get sent home in the mail. And it just, it seems like this group of kids just didn't get what they deserve because it's a big accomplishment.
Thanks for that, Noelle. And I, you know, I also take from that to all three of our students that she's congratulating you also on that big accomplishment, which I know she is. You know, Noelle was talking about the loss of a lot of closure. Is closure a piece of this for any of the three of you? Is there something you needed to sort of get a sense that you had finished that you now don't feel like you finished? Let me turn to you
well,
on that.
For me,
yeah, go ahead.
Oh, well, for me, definitely, I was very, very looking forward to walking across the stage. I've been to some friends' graduations when I wasn't a senior yet, and I was friends with upperclassmen, and I thought it was always a very special ceremony. So I was really, really looking forward to that. Not also that, but at Fenway, we do this internship at the end of the year, so I feel like that was also almost like, for me, I guess it was going to feel almost like my first real job since I haven't really had a real job before. So I think that's one of the things that I'm definitely going to miss. And I would have really, really loved to walk across the stage in front of my parents.
I have another call I want to get in here. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What is your message to seniors? Is there someone you want to congratulate? Are you a high school senior who's missing something that you really wanted out of the end of the year? We've got Robin on the line from Brookline. Robin, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for having it. And Kat and Rashad, the rest of the world knows me as Robin, but you know me as Miss Cohen. But you can now know me as Robin because you are officially Fenway graduates. But I wanted to call and congratulate all the seniors, but especially Rashad and Kat and their 85 classmates from Fenway's class of 2020 for handling their senior year with such grace and humility and flexibility. This is not how anyone pictured their senior year, and yet they just adapted and went with the flow. And you know, they didn't push back their emotions. They felt their emotions, but they really handled it really with just such grace. My senior year of high school was 9/11, and I grew up right outside New York City, so it's very, very different, but also a key world event happened, and I'm just so proud of how they and their classmates went with it. And I know this is not how it was supposed to end, but we're sending you virtual hugs and virtual prom pictures, and we will be back together to celebrate sometime soon. So congratulations, guys. Your Fenway family is very proud of you.
Thank you so much for that call. Rashad, you just had one of your teachers call on public radio to congratulate you. How does that feel?
Like I said earlier, I think it's really great. I think in the recent times, a lot of faculty, a lot of program directors and staff, they've done like a lot of like cool things like parades, like the prom or virtual graduations and stuff like that. So it really shows how much they care and how much they appreciate us. And I feel like, yeah, it's really a good feeling. It's warming and rewarding to see that they value you as much as you value them. So I think it's just a great feeling.
And Kat, this is the third interruption of high school that you've experienced. First, you moved during high school, then West Roxbury Academy closed at the beginning of last year and you had attended there. And now the coronavirus cuts short your senior year at Fenway. There was a teacher sort of complimenting you on how well you've handled that. That is a lot of change for a young person.
It definitely is. Some might say, I've heard a lot of people like, oh my God, how do you do it? And because it is a really big change, just move from a whole different state, like from Florida to here, and then have it interrupted because of the closure and then now coronavirus. Surprisingly, I've dealt with it a lot better than I thought I would. And it hasn't interrupted any of my learning or any of my growing up, which I think is great. I think if anything, it has taught me a lot about myself. Although it's definitely not ideal. I would have loved to have a traditional high school experience, but I also think I wouldn't be the person I am today without all these interruptions. So in a way, I think I'm also grateful for everything.
And Mattingly, I do want to get to you again. You've mentioned that in the limbo between, you know, school closing and graduation, you kind of didn't feel prepared for the transition. You couldn't go outside and get that work experience, the taste of independence that you needed. You know, how are you feeling about that now?
Yeah, definitely. Like my job at Cambridge Community Television shut down and I was basically just like sitting at home. So it was definitely a weird shift and I'm kind of scared about not being able to work before college starts. So I'm kind of just a little bit hesitant about my future right now, but I feel like now that lockdown has been happening for a while, I feel a little bit better and kind of trying to use my time to the best of my advantage.
Rashad, we have only just very little bit of time left. How do you want your class to be remembered?
I think the class of 2020 is already building a legacy, whether it knows it or not. I think Mattingly said earlier, but seeing all these different celebrations around TV and just around the nation for the class of 20 builds an amazing, amazing legacy. And also in recent times with the events that have happened with racial injustice around the nation, I think with these young leaders stepping up from the class of 2020 and just young people in general, we're making a real change in the world. And we, like a lot of people are going to say, we're a class that no one expected to go through this, but I feel like there's a lot of lessons that we can learn from this, and we definitely can use it to be change makers and world shakers and our future adventures and stuff that we do in the world.
All right, Rashad Brown Mitchell, Kat Giglio, and Mattingly Wood, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having
me.
Thank you.
And lastly, in the world altered by the coronavirus, many things are more difficult. But musician Judith Kogan is finding that the work to overcome those challenges can be well worth the effort.
In the isolation of the pandemic, many people are picking up musical instruments. There's time for it. Music consoles and delights. It's a welcome break from screens, and for the determined, progress is palpable. But for those who'd been studying or teaching an instrument the old-fashioned way, the pandemic poses unique challenges. Live and in person would seem essential. It's all about nuance of sound achieved through nuance of motion. A 360-degree view and unmediated sound would seem essential. I'm a classically trained harpist and harp teacher. With the lockdown, I thought I'd suspend lessons until we were allowed to enter each other's homes. But my students, digital natives carrying on with the rest of their lives online, saw no reason harp lessons shouldn't move there as well. Trust your students. It's not better than before. There are weird electronic distortions, like the screen that turns taut harp strings into twirling strings of twisty licorice.
The string just went really weird.
And compression distorts the volume of sound.
I didn't hear that top note. Did you play it?
Yeah.
Imagine a soccer or tennis clinic where the coach has a single flat perspective. You really need every angle.
Can you move the camera to your right elbow?
But it turns out there are benefits to teaching harp online. With most of the room cut out, there are fewer distractions. When three dimensions collapse into two, there's a weird intimacy. You can get up close, like ballroom dance partners. The students are more alert than ever. I see them when they're fresh, not after a sleepless night finishing a term paper. And they're practicing. Maybe they're bored at home? Waves of positive reinforcement from parents can't hurt.
My mom, during quarantine, like every morning, she's been asking me to like play for like 30 minutes, and she like drinks coffee while I'm playing, and like after every song, she like starts to clap.
There's a master-apprentice tradition to the centuries-old teaching of classical music. It's intimate and detail-oriented, and incorporates the ineffable power of the classical canon. Given the surreal times, we explore repertoire outside that canon. It's like a class in Shakespeare suddenly reading Pulp Fiction. Whenever possible, we find parallels to the strange moment we're living in.
It needs to be giddy and exuberant, like the lockdown has just ended and we can finally go outside.
Okay.
Again?
Online lessons have forced us to see and hear from a new perspective. That's important for artists, for all of us, actually. We adjust and adapt because, as John Lennon and Paul McCartney remind us, life goes on.
Judith Kogan is a professional harpist and a harp teacher. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walt Wolfman. Tim Skog is our technical director with engineering today by Glenn Alexander. Hitesh Hathi is our executive producer. Thanks for listening.